Yeah, so this will be a continuing the lecture I gave like 2 weeks ago. So last time I talked about a conventional and unconventional quantum field points, but so this week, I mean this time we'll just be unconventional quantum field points. So thank you all for coming again, and thank you for letting me torture you guys again. So again, this, I mean, it's a serious lecture, so again, a lot of your questions, I apologize for that. So the first topic will be like 2 plus 1 dimension O3 nonlinear sigma model. This seems to be a very simple theory, but I'm going to talk about the theory with one extra feature, which is a conserved Skirmian number. So this conserved Skirmian number will make the O3 nonlinear sigma model very non-trivial, and this is actually the basic idea of the deconfined criticality. And then I'm going to talk about some stable critical phases. So all the critical points I talked about before, basically is just, I mean, they are all conformal field theory. They're all critical, but there's always a relevant perturbation as the conformal field theory, which we can tune to drive through the phase transition. But in condensed matter system, in some cases, we can have a stable conformal field theory, which means that there's no relevant perturbation at all. It remains stable against any symmetry allowed perturbations. So there are several examples like this. And then the third part is optional, depending on how much time I have and how much discussion we will have in the, on the way. So third one will be some duality between spin and topological defects. And we can show the precise duality in the infrared limit. And this kind of situation can occur in both like three-dimensional cubic lattice and two-dimensional triangular lattice. And we can show this exact spin and topological defect duality as the infrared. Okay, so first of all, the 2 plus 1 dimension O3 nonlinear sigma model. So this nonlinear sigma model is very, very simple, just a one term with the constraint n squared equals 1, and n is the O3 vector. So if we don't add any constraint to this model, then this model becomes a conventional O3 nonlinear sigma model. And the phase diagram of the model is very simple. We tune the one parameter g with the coupling constant g. And when g is very small, in 2 plus 1 dimension, when g is very small, the n will order. When n order, it breaks the O3 symmetry to U1 symmetry, and the ground state manifold will be S2, which is a two-dimensional sphere. And it's gapless because of the Goldstone mode. And when g is very large, in 2 plus 1 dimension, then n will be disordered. And based on this model, this will be a featureless ground state and complete disorder and gapped out. There's no Goldstone mode in this phase because of disorder. And this critical point GC will be described as standard Wilson Fisher O3 fixed point. It's a very standard thing.
Excuse me, is there some special reason for writing 2 plus 1 instead of 3?
Oh, because I'm going to talk about conservation of stuff. So when you talk about conservation of
later on.
I mean, so here it doesn't make a difference, but later on we're going to talk about conservation of some topological defect in two-dimensional space. So I had better mention two-dimensional instead of three-dimensional space-time, or three-dimensional Euclidean space. So yeah, okay. So conventional O3 sigma model, nonlinear sigma model means that a Skirmian number is not conserved. It's not conserved means, okay, so what is Skirmian? Skirmian is this kind of topological defect. Basically, it means in a finite region of the two-dimensional space, inside the region, the spin wheel pointing up, and outside the region, the spin wheel pointing down. And there's a continuous evolution from the up to down spin in this circle area. So this is called Skirmian, and it's localized in a finite region of a two-dimensional space, and it's characterized by this kind of second homotopy group, pi 2 s 2 equals z. Okay. And we can write a topological number calculating the Skirmian number, which is some number like this, and integrate over the whole two-dimensional space, we calculate how many Skirmians are there in the space. So conventional O3 nonlinear sigma model means that the Skirmian number is not conserved. So this sentence means that if we consider 2 plus 1 dimensional space-time, it means that in the space-time you allow this kind of the hedgehog-like monopole configuration in space-time. We allow this kind of configuration to occur in the two plus one dimensional space time or three dimensional Euclidean space. If we allow this kind of configuration to occur, it means that we can change the Skirman number by one. We can change the Skirman number by one with time evolution with this kind of a monopole in the two plus one dimensional space time. Okay. And it's called hedgehog like monopole. Yeah. Okay. So unconventional O3 non sigmoidal means that the Skirman number is conserved. So this means that we suppress the monopole configuration, which means we do not allow the existence of the monopole in the space-time. It is forbidden to happen. So in this case, it means that the Skirman number becomes conserved. It means the O3 non sigmoidal have one extra conservation law, which is the conservation of the Skirman. So it means that the symmetry of the unconventional O3 non sigmoidal with the conserved Skirman number is no longer O3 anymore. It becomes O3 cross U1 and O3 cross O2. So this U1 corresponds to a conservation of the Skirman number. So once we have a conservation of something, we should have an extra symmetry. So this implies that now the phase diagram of the O3 non sigmoidal is modified. So if we tune the carbon constant G here, when G is small, we still have an ordered phase. Vector N is ordered. And the Grandstein manifold is still S2, and it's still gapless with the Goldstone mode, with the two branches of Goldstone mode, because we have a two-dimensional Grandstein manifold here. But when G is large, we are supposed to be in a disordered phase, but the disordered phase is supposed to be a condensate of a Skirman, And the condensate of a Skirman will spontaneously break this U1 symmetry. So which means that in the disordered phase, actually becomes the ordered phase with a Goldstone mode associated with a spontaneous symmetry breaking of the U1, and it has a Grandstein manifold S1.
What are you doing to the model to suppress the Skirman?
Here it's not clear, but I will show that how to do that later. After we introduce a CP1 model, we can show how we suppress the monopole. Okay, so once we suppress the monopole configuration, once we preserve the conservation of the Skirman number, this phase transition becomes a phase transition between S2 to S1, the two-dimensional sphere to one-dimensional circle. This is a phase transition. Now the question is what is the universality class of the transition? Because now the phase diagram changed, so the universality class will not be the same as the also Wilson Fisher anymore. It have some.
Excuse me. Can I continue with my question? Because somehow the time dimension was treated the same way as this, right?
Sorry.
The time dimension was treated the same way as the spatial dimension, as far as I understand.
Right.
So meaning that you could simply write 3 instead of 2 plus 1.
Sure, you can. Formally you can, but I want to talk about the conservation. I want to talk about the conservation of something. So I mean conservation of a particle moving a two-dimensional space instead of a three-dimensional Euclidean.
I understand that your original model could be a two-dimensional quantum model, and the origin of this third dimension is imaginary time. But once the model is formulated,
formulated, it's the same. Yeah,
the critical exponent z.
Yeah,
is one,
it's
right?
It's the same. It's the same. Z is one. Z is definitely one. Yeah.
Isn't it stuck with 3?
Right. So formally, once you write down the equation, they're all the same.
You're not discussing the origin of your model. You just wrote it as a model.
Right. But if you want to understand the physical picture, which is the conservation of something, then I had better talk about 2 plus 1 dimension instead of 3 dimension. But it doesn't matter.
Is it possible to understand your model as just a classical 3 dimensional Heisenberg model in which neighboring spins are not allowed to have a large angle?
That's a very good question. So basically you're asking how what do we do to suppress a monopole? Actually, to do this, it's actually quite subtle. If we give our model if we put a too strong condition, two strong constraints to the model, like we don't allow the candidate angle to be too large. Actually, if we make the constraint too strong, actually the model cannot be disordered at all. It will always be ordered. So we have to do it in a very subtle way, actually.
So you want to prohibit Skirmions, but you don't want to prohibit some other types of topological defects, right?
Actually, it's like we want to preserve a Skirman number, but I want to allow the local spin fluctuation. So I don't want to have this kind of topological defect,
but you want to allow hedgehog anti-hedgehog pairs.
Yeah, locally I want, so better way to that, so I want to allow the monopole converter to be very close to each other, but I don't want to separate monopole configurations.
Any distance, so they can stay arbitrarily far away from each other in your model, or there is some cutoff, and they cannot go
Something. That is a very subtle question. Actually, so, I mean, I would suggest to read some papers which actually numerically study the O3 9 sigma model with the suppression of the monopole. Actually, the conclusion of the papers are different. Some people say that with the suppression of monopole, we cannot disorder at all. But some papers say that, well, I mean, if we do it in a clever way, we can disorder and we have some new fixed point. But this problem actually is quite subtle, actually. So I'll list some reference and later. If you're interested, you can see those papers.
Skew mirror number conservation, does that mean complete suppression of monopole, or could I still have them in pairs? Pairs and still.
Well, basically, I want to say that you allow monopole to be close to each other, plus or minus pair to be close to each other. I mean, so I want to say that globally the Skirman number is conserved. Globally, I want the Skirman number to be conserved. So which means I don't allow the single monopole to be created. You know, this is literally, I mean, precisely, I mean, this is what it means. But suppose you allow the monopole to be far away from each other, then that means that there's an energy scale beyond which it will become O3-like. Below it, it will become the new unified collider. So, you know, so, I mean, literally it means that you don't have monopole in the whole space, this is actually.
So do you impose the condition by adding a non-local term to the action? So what's your Hamiltonian? So your action is not what is shown here, right?
Sorry?
Your action is not what is shown here. You need to add something that conserves the number.
Well, so far I only have field theory. I didn't even talk about the lattice model yet, and I don't plan to talk about lattice model. There are papers studying that. You can add a local term to suppress a monopole, but those terms are very complicated. I prefer not to write them down, actually. Certainly there are terms you can add to a Hamiltonian lattice O3 classical model to suppress a monopole. That's something you can do, but I'm not planning to show that. Okay.
So to continue to clarify, so when you say that you are allowing monopole to be close to each other, do you mean close to each other in space or close to each other in space-time?
I think in space-time. Yeah, especially when you want to suppress in the action. You want to suppress in the action, yeah. Okay, so what's the universality class after we suppress the monopole configuration, after we just preserve the Skirman number conservation? So the simplest way to formulate this theory when we suppress the monopole is to introduce the CP1 formula. For instance, which is the decompose of vector n in terms of z dagger sigma z. It's kind of a standard way of doing the CP1 mapping. And after we introduce the spin on z, turns out that we are allowed to do an arbitrary U1 rotation on z on any location of the space. So this means that we actually introduce a U1 gauge degree of freedom on the spin on z. So in order to make sure the symmetry of the O3 non-C model and the symmetry of the CP1 model equivalent, I have to introduce a U1 gauge field on the CP1 field Z. So this will be the field theory describing the CP1 field. So Z will be coupled to a U1 gauge field. Okay, Z will be coupled to a U1 gauge field. Okay, so this model actually, obviously have two phases. One is that when Z condense. When Z condense, it's going to be the Higgs phase, which means the U1 gauge field Higgs out. It'll completely gap it out, and the gauge invariant or the parameter will be n, with z dagger sigma z will be n. Okay. And however, when z is gapped out, then we lose the order of n, but we still have a photon. So basically, this model have two phases. One is the Higgs phase, and one is the photon phase. Turns out the Higgs phase is identical to the ordered phase, have a Gaussian manifold S2, because the gauge invariant order parameter is just n. And the photon phase has one branches of a photon excitation. Turns out the photon excitation is the dual version of the Goldstone mode of the Skirman condensation. Okay, basically the Goldstone mode of the Skirman condensate is a dual of photon. Okay.
Excuse me, may I ask again? You are in three space-time dimensions now. You have a photon with a U1 degree of freedom, right?
U1 gauge degree of freedom. Yeah.
Okay. And the Higgs field has what symmetry now?
This one, Z have SU2.
It's a two-bit signal.
Right.
And the U1-bit signal.
Yeah, U1-bit. So the constant magnitude will be SU2 mod U1. It's S2. It's the, sorry. It's S2. Right. Okay, so we have two phases. One is Higgs phase, one is photon phase. Okay, so when Z is uncondensed, the gauge field is in the photon phase. And actually, based on the standard duality between the superfluid and the gauge field in 2 plus 1 dimension, the 2 plus 1 dimensional photon phase is in fact a condensate of its flux. It's in fact a condensate of a gauge flux. It's a standard duality between the U1 gauge field and the superfluid in 2 plus 1 dimension. Then the condensate of flux means that we are spontaneously breaking the conservation of the gauge flux. Turns out the gauge flux, based on the standard CP1 to O3 and C1 mapping, this gauge flux is equivalent to the Skirman number. The gauge flux is equivalent to the Skirman number using the standard CP1 to the O3 single model mapping. So this means that
usually QE3 is compartment, right? Well, why
here? No, this is the 2 plus 1. Okay. That's why we call it a non-compact CP1 model.
But if we start from the lattice model, actually this gauge field is compact.
Depending on what kind of order you're talking about. I'm going to show you the example when the U1 gauge field is not confined. I mean, it's not compact.
Okay. So basically, I guess Zheng Chen's question is that if you start with a conventional O3 model, and if you want to describe it using this language, then the gauge field would be a compact gauge field.
That's not exactly clear, depending on what kind of O3 order you're talking about.
The gauge field is uncompact, it will not be quantized. There's a problem in the quantization.
No, Skirman can carry quantum number. When a Skirman carries something quantum, when the quantum number is conserved, then the CP1 model will be non-compact.
No, but it's non-compact, you can only do the classical limit. There's if we do non-perturbative calculation, there's a problem.
Sorry, say again?
I mean for non-compact U1 gauge theory, actually, if we you want to do some serious calculation, there's a cutoff problem. You could not associate with some problem cutoff. In any high energy physics, you know, they always start from this SU2 compact gauge field theory, then use the Higgs to break it to U1. And at classical level, there's no distinguish between uncompact or compact U1. But actually, if you want to explicitly write down everything, well defined lattice model, actually the U1 should be compact.
Well, I mean, okay, so I'm going to show you an example later why this guy becomes conserved. Okay, I mean, I understand once you decompose n equals z dagger sigma z, then the U1 is compact in the sense that a is equivalent to a plus 2 pi. But in many systems, the flux will carry some quantum number, which will make it effectively conserved at a low energy. Okay, that makes the theory non-compact at a low energy. Okay, although maybe when you do it on the lattice, it's going to be.
Yeah, you mean it's just a semi-classical limit, right?
What's a semi-classical limit?
Low energy limit means this kind of semi-classical limit of gauge field. In semi-classical limit, you can treat it as some uncompact. But if you really doing this,
semi-classical limit is a word, right? I'm just talking about low energy. So once the theory has a low energy limit, then you can expand it as a mean field.
But you assume the low energy limit is just like some quantum oscillator, like a harmonic oscillator in your semi-classical limit. You can see.
Oh.
Uncompact. Assume there's a strong interactions in that limit, actually. I think the compactness is important.
So can anyone explain what he said to me again?
Just one comment here. If you start with, suppose you initially declare that you are working with not O3 model, but O3 cross U1 model. In the beginning, you say that I'm specifying there are no hedgehogs. Then obviously it's not compact from there itself. That's one way to start it.
Okay, yeah.
Then the possibility is O3
cross. Okay, that might be a good way to say. So my starting point is not the O3 model, it's O3 cross U1 model.
Right.
But that's where still we have to say that O3 and U1, they are not, one is associated with a local object, the other is associated with topological defect. So that's a special thing. Yeah, okay. Yeah. But I think in general question that once we do the kind of CP1 formula on a lattice, I'm always starting with I'm always starting with a compact CPU, I mean, compact U1 gate, this is true. But what I want to say is that depending on what kind of O3 model you are talking about, at low energy, this kind of this kind of gate flux will be attached with a certain quantum number. And that quantum number is conserved, which will make the, which will grant the conservation to the U1 gate flux, which make it non-compact at low energy. You know, so what you would do on that is starting point, and that's going to be compact. So, I think we should talk about examples. I mean, instead of formalism. So, okay. Did I finish this part actually? So I want to emphasize the flux is actually equal to Skirman numbers, which means the conservation of flux is equivalent to the conservation of Skirman. So I just want to say that the conservation of the gauge flux implies that the gauge theory is non-compact. Okay, non-compact. So which means that once we want to preserve the conservation of the Skirman, it implies that the CP1 in the CP1 model, the U1 gate field is non-compact. This is what we want to discuss. Okay. So example. The first example is the most well-known example is the deconfinement criticality. So if the vector n is not a suppose the vector n is the new order. It's just a standard new order on like square lattice or honeycomb lattice. I mean, let's talk about square lattice. Okay, let's forget about the honeycomb. Let's talk about square lattice. So new order on a square lattice, then suppose we calculate the quantum number. So we just do a calculation, just a brute force calculation of the quantum number of the Skirman. We are going to realize that the Skirman will carry the lattice momentum. So this calculation was done by Hodan and then later on by Reed and Sachdev. In late 80s and early 90s. So it turns out that this Q will carry a lattice quantum number, I mean, lattice momentum. So this means that the condensation of the Skirman actually has to break the lattice translation and the rotation symmetry, and does not break any other symmetry. So which means that we are going to see some Weismann solid pattern like this. Turns out on square lattice, the Skirman will carry some convention rate, carry some conventional momentum. So turns out that a Weismann solid will have the kind of a very standard columnar type of Weismann solid, some convention rate Weismann solid pattern on the lattice. Okay. So this actually does not look like our proposal, because here I want to have S1, okay, but here I have Z4. So which means in this system the gauge flux is not completely conserved. It's conserved by V4. Okay, it's conserved mod V4. So we allow the quadrupole. So basically, we allow the full monopole to appear to be generated in the space time, but we don't allow a single monopole to generate. So this means that this S1 is U1 symmetry broken down to a Z4 symmetry in this system. So the idea of the deconfinement criticality is that this Z4 symmetry breaking effect is only relevant here. But it's irrelevant in this phase, certainly, and also irrelevant at this critical point. So basically, this is like the proposed RG flow diagram for the Z4 symmetry breaking, okay, for the U1 to Z4 symmetry breaking. It means that, so this nominal form is like a quadruple monopole, something like that. So it means that this operator, flow to zero at the critical point, which is non-compact CP1 field theory. But it's going to be dangerously relevant. So it will eventually become relevant when we are slightly away from this critical point. So it's RG flow.
Actually, I think this phase translation can also be understood without this uncompact U1 gate field. You can just start from this Z4 VBA state and consider the topological defect of this Z4 symmetry breaking order. Then you condense the defect, actually you get this new order.
Well, I mean, then you have to assume that the defect of the Weismann solid order carries a spinner, as you do spinner, right?
Yeah.
But then, if you formulate your field theory starting with that, you end up with CP1 model. You end up with CP1 model eventually, actually. Since you assume like the vortex of the Weismann solid order carries spinner,
yeah.
Then you started to talk about how do we proliferate the vortex carrying spinner.
Yeah.
Then the vortex you describe is the SU2 spinner, and this guy is coupled to the quasi-Goldstone mode of the Weismann solid order, which will due to U1 gauge field. So eventually you end up with the SU2 spinner coupled with the U1 gauge field, which becomes the CP1 model. Right. So this actually was shown by Sencho and Michael Levy.
But in that case, the U1 can be compact.
Well, in that case, the U1 will become non-compact at this point, at the critical point. but will becoming the compactness of U1 gauge field becomes becomes irrelevant, and you cannot see it as a critical point.
Yeah, but we'll, I agree. Yeah, because right, it's just a classical limit, so it's not important.
Okay. I mean, when you talk about semi-classical limit, we should talk about what kind of mean field starting point we are talking about, right?
And
we
shouldn't just. I mean, our compact U1 gauge field only have perturbative definition. You don't have a non-perturbative definition for that.
Okay, I'm going to show you a non-perturbative example. This was done by Taran. It's by Taran. So if the n is vector n, if the vector n is actually not a near order, it's a quantum spin Hall order parameter, still it's an O3 vector. Then if you calculate a Skirman number carried by the vector n, it's like carries charge 2e. So now the Skirman is precisely conserved instead of z4 conserved. Okay. So in this case, the CP1 model becomes completely non-compact. I mean, instead of a z4 compact or something like that. So the Skirman becomes completely conserved.
But you cannot put this model on the lattice model.
Well, we can.
You can?
Certainly. The quantum spin Hall order parameter you can write on the lattice. There's no problem. Okay. Right. Okay. So now, so in this system, I mean, certainly we can drive a phase transition between the quantum spin Hall type of order to a superconductor, and this transition will be described as CP1 model precisely because this transition is precisely a transition between a ground state manifold S2 to a ground state manifold S1, which is the superconductor order. It's like superconductor has S1. And this theory is actually a CP1 field theory. And there's no dangerously irrelevant operator that we have to worry about. Okay. So here let's talk about a little bit more qualitative understanding, of the CP1 model. Certainly as a theorist, I mean, we cannot really do much controlled calculation except for something like epsilon expansion or one length expansion. So to study CPN model more quantitatively, actually we can do the one length expansion. For instance, we can increase the number of spin-on from 2 to n. From 2 to n. So this model will have the SUn symmetry instead of SU2 symmetry. Then starting from a large n limit, we can perturbatively calculate the critical exponent, like the nu and the eta, which is the enormous dimension of the order parameter, of the O3 order parameter. Then turns out nu will be like a 1 minus 1 of n order, and then eta will be 1 minus 1 of n order as well. So it turns out, so this eta number is actually very important because it shows that in the large n limit, eta will be 1, and eta is not small at all. So this actually means that the eta of the CP1 model is not small. Okay, so it turns out that here there are a bunch of numerical calculations. The first two papers is about the famous JQ model, which actually shows a direct signal transition between the near order and the one spun solid order in certain in a Heisenberg model with the in a spin model with both Heisenberg coupling and a four spin coupling. Okay. And there, this paper by Martinich and Ashwin Vishwanath actually was simulating a classical CP1 model. And in all those three papers actually shows that the eta, which is the enormous dimension for the O3 order parameter as the critical point, is not small. Okay. It's something
when
like
n is large, you don't have a hedgehogs any longer. So what plays the role of Skirmion conservation?
Sorry, say again?
If n is large, so Skirmions you described emerge when n is 3. Now you can see the large n. So what plays the role of Skirmion conservation in that situation?
No, pi 2 CPN is z. So for CPN model, we always have Skirmion-like.
So
Skirmion can be generalized to CPN model.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, and the CP1 is CP1 basically is S2, right?
Okay.
Is S2, so yeah. Okay. So eta is not small in the CPN model at least. So let's compare the ON. I showed this table in the last time. So let's compare the CPN and the ON model, ON Wilson Fisher. So last time I mentioned is for the ON Wilson Fisher model, the nu, when n goes to infinity, nu will go to 1. Will increase and go to 1. And the eta is some very, very tiny number. And when n goes to infinity, eta will go to 0 for the ON Wilson Fisher fixed point. But for the CPN model, actually the situation is different, which means that nu actually will also go to 1 when n goes to infinity, but eta will go to 1 when n goes to infinity. Okay, so this means that, so actually by checking the number eta, we can have some quality of, so we can tell the difference between this kind of exotic transition and a conventional transition by calculating the number eta. Okay, so this is some understanding. Okay, so there are some theoretical conjecture made by Cento and Matthew a few years ago, which is that the non-compact CP1 model is actually equivalent to O3 nonlinear sigma model with a Wessel-Minow-Witten term in a 2+1 dimension. Okay, so these two models looks very different. So how do we understand there's a connection between them? So the O5 nonlinear sigma model, so how do we get the O5 vector here? So it turns out the three components of the O5 vector come from this O3 vector. So this O3 vector is a three of the five component. And here we have a Skirmian condensate, which will make the Gaussian mantle for S1. So this S1 can be described by a two component vector. Okay, two component vector, just a two component rotor. So in total, it's 3+2=5. So this O5 vector contains this O3 vector and O2 vector from here. And why do we have a Wessel-Minow-Witten term? So this term actually looks very odd, but this term literally means that the Skirmian of a three component of the O5 vector contains the quantum number of the other two component. Okay. So this Wessel-Minow term literally means that, means the Skirmian of the three component of them contains the quantum number of the other two. Okay. So which actually captures the physics described by CP1 model, because CP1 model tells us that the Skirmian, the Skirmian of the O3 vector actually is the condensate of the other phase. So basically, it's a conjecture. So the conjecture is like this. But suppose the conjecture is true. So let's say suppose the conjecture is true, then it implies that in 2+1 dimension or three dimensional O3 nonlinear sigma model with the Wessel-Minow-Witten term, the RG flow for the coupling constant will look like this. Okay. So this fixed point G1 star is the order disorder phase transition fixed point between the O5 ordered phase and disorder phase. But in addition to this fixed point, we should have another fixed point. It's a stable fixed point, and it's a liquid phase. It's a conformal field theory. And this fixed point corresponds to the critical point of the CP1 model. This fixed point should correspond to the critical point of the CP1 model. Okay, so which means if this conjecture is true, then we should have the kind of RG flow that way for the coupling constant G.
How do you establish that the G2 fixed point is stable?
Because suppose CP1 field theory is stable, and suppose the critical point is due to this guy. Because suppose we want to tune the transition, suppose we want to tune the CP1, I mean tune the transition CP1 model, we have to break the O5 symmetry. So it means that at this fixed point there should be only one relevant perturbation, which is the O5 symmetry breaking relevant perturbation. Okay. So we have a turn another axis which breaks the O5 symmetry. So that will be the relevant perturbation, and that will be tuning through the phase transition here. But without the O5 symmetry breaking, this fixed one should be there. Okay.
What's the first critical point?
This is the order disorder. So like when you have a nonlinear sigma model in 2+1 dimension, when G is very small, you're supposed to see order. O5 is order. So.
I think the empirical input for JQ model, shouldn't I then say that? Suppose I take the numerical evidence from the JQ model, shouldn't I say that MCP1 model is good enough to O3 cross O2 non-nonlinear sigma model with visible magnetic term? Well, I mean, well, I thought in result is that the new and the VBS have the same scaling dimension. They're very different, 0.2 and 0.35. Well, I mean, I thought, I thought we made error bar. Is that true, Roger?
You're talking about the ages for the VBS? I'd say they're the same thin error bars. Yeah.
Which are big. But still, that would be more conservative thing to say.
Sure. I mean, suppose I'm a very, very rigorous person. I shouldn't show this slide. But I'm a more ambitious person, so I should show this slide. Because this slide makes the world much, much more beautiful, actually. more beautiful to me. So I mean, so I hope the conjecture is true. It means that there's an emergent all five symmetry at a fixed point, and also it has a Westermann Richter term. Okay, and this one comparison I want to make is that if we lower the dimension, if we go to the 1 plus 1 dimensional O4 nonlinear single model, then the 1 plus 1 dimensional O4 nonlinear single model with the Westermann Richter term will have such a fixed point. And this actually is well understood. If you got the so this is a 1 plus 1 dimensional O4 nonlinear single model with Westermann Richter term. There's a stable fixed point when G flow, because suppose we don't have this term. So when we don't have this term, then G will just flow to infinity. G will go to infinity on the RG flow. But with this term, G will stop at some fixed point value. And this fixed point corresponds to SU2 level 1 Westermann-Witten model, and also it's just the standard SU2 spin half chain. Okay, to describe standard SU2 spin half chain. That's described by this fixed point. Okay. So so I hope this is true, but I don't know how to prove it. So if any of you have any idea about it, please tell me. This has been my goal for like a while, but I don't know how to prove it.
Is it possible then to construct some Fermion model coupled to some order parameter?
Yes.
O5 symmetry.
You can obtain this Westermann-Witten model, but I don't know a controlled way to show this fixed point. If we do.
Maybe. There should be a stable gapless phase if you don't break the O5 symmetry.
Well, then we probably should start with an interacting Dirac Fermion type of a Hamiltonian, right? We can turn on lander and we search for such a fixed point, stable fixed point, right? That's possible. Yeah, but I really want to have a theoretically kind of controlled way of showing this. I mean, actually, if we do all kinds of expansion, we do kind of one of n expansion or Eiffel expansion, we have a controlled way of showing this fixed point is no problem. But this fixed point will not be controlled, will not be suppressed by one of n. It will always be uncontrolled. So I don't know how to show that. So. Yeah, okay. How much time do I have? Okay, so.
20.
Okay. Okay, so basically, so this is like a last thing I want to say about decompound criticality. So there are still a lot of work to do to fully understand the decompound critical point. Okay, so the next slide will be a different topic. It will be like a stable critical phase. So before, all the critical points, no matter conventional or unconventional, they're all just a critical point. It means that there's always a relevant perturbation allowed by the system, which we can turn on to drive the transition through the critical point. But now, actually in condensed matter system, there are certain system that we have a stable critical phase, which means that it's still conformal field theory with a specific scaling dimension to all the primary field, but we don't have so there's no symmetry allowed perturbation which can destroy the conformal field theory at infrared. Okay, so this kind of a stable conformal field usually occurs in a spin liquid context. So spin liquid is a crazy concept actually. So we do this kind of crazy thing by decomposing the spin operator in terms of to a fermion operator. They are called spinum. And after we do this, we have to impose some constraint to make sure that on every side the spin has a definite representation. Okay. For instance, this is some constraint we impose. We impose like the so we just require the fermion density, spin-down density on every side is a fixed number, number C. And this number C will fix the representation of the spin model on every side. Okay. So as usual, once we do this kind of a trick, we split the spin into two fermion. Actually, once we do this, the gauge symmetry will kick in. Okay, the gauge field will come in, and depending on what kind of a mean field solution we want the spin on F to have, the gauge symmetry can be either SU2 or U1 or Z2 or sometimes even SUn. N can be very large. Okay, we have all kinds of gauge symmetry going on. And basically, the F we want to fill some mean field band structure, and the band structure sometimes we have fermion surface, sometimes Dirac fermion, and the Dirac fermion is certainly people's favorite because it's easy to handle, much easier to handle than fermion surface. And once we have the gauge field come in, we should always only count the gauge invariant operators instead of gauge dependent operators. Okay.
These conclusions, I'm not sure, are you're assuming these things like the dispersion relations, or you're deriving this somehow?
We can, I'm trying to be sloppy about this. Certainly, the dispersion will depend on mean field solution, mean field choice, depend on mean field variational parameters. But basically, you have to find the minimum of the mean field theory, and then you use the mean field solution to derive the dispersion of the spin off.
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand the order of logic. So you write down a field theory.
No, so far no field theory yet. I mean, so we start with a lattice model. Okay. And we do mean field theory on the lattice. And the mean field, so after we determine the mean field parameter, the theory will only become a two-body Hamiltonian, a two-body mean field Hamiltonian. And in that two-body mean field Hamiltonian, spin down will have a band structure. And then starting from that, the lattice band structure, we go to the continuum limit of that lattice band structure, then we go to field theory. But I'm not going to show you the whole.
No, it's fine. I'm just trying to understand what you're assuming and what's the sort of the starting point of what's assumed and then what's actually then. So you're assuming that mean field theory
It's good.
So you're assuming that mean field theory on this lattice model with a particular, well, assuming somehow spin on mean field theory or something
right.
like that is a correct description.
Correct description.
And then given that assumption, you then derive.
And I'm going to show you in some cases this mean field solution and actually the fluctuation on top of the mean field solution is exactly right. I'm going to show you an example like that.
Okay.
So even though this formula looks very crazy, it turns out in some cases it gives us a precise answer.
Actually, if you from the variational wave function point of view, it's kind of some exact projective wave function, right?
That's a projective wave function, but I'm not sure whether exact is there. It's a wave function, but we don't know whether it's a ground state wave function or not. Right?
Yeah, so it's kind of a class of variational wave function. Then you project this spin onto the spin.
Yeah, but actually the U1 gate field is supposed to be equivalent to the projection. That's the philosophy. Okay. I mean, maybe that's thing I should mention. Okay. So we can either do projection to project the mean field Hilbert space to this constrained Hilbert space, or we can just turn on gauge field. The philosophy is that turning on gauge field is equivalent to doing this projection.
But the gauge field usually there's no dynamic terms, so the fluctuation can be extremely strong.
No, the gauge field dynamic can be generated. It's always generated, right? I mean, here I'm not talking about the background gauge field, the dynamical gauge field.
Yeah. And how many species of Fermat you have? If you have many species, like in large n limits, there's a controlled calculation. But if it's small, I think there's no.
Yeah, and I know. So well, I mean, yeah, that's why that's why I really like the alkaline earth cold atom thing. It would give you n very big. And in some cases, even large n cannot save you. So in some cases, large n cannot even give you a controlled calculation either. But we have Fermi surface, large n does not help you at all. So,
So this philosophy of the gauge field being line constrained, is that similar to the notion of the fractional quantum Ball effect, say, where you sort of couple your Fermions bosons to Chern Simons gauge field? Is it the same kind of philosophy?
No, I think that's different. So there, there.
But no Chern Simons term. Don't break time reversal symmetry.
Well, I think he's asking more philosophy level. So, I mean, there, I think the U1 gauge field there is some dual. So that U1 gauge is a dual of the current. We'll derive Chern Simons. So here, the gauge field is really a gauge field. It's not dual of any current. So. Okay, so I want to do large n now because that's the limit that in many cases we can do controlled calculation. So let's talk about examples. Okay, let's talk about examples. So example is that we consider SUN magnet on the honeycomb lattice or squirrel lattice, and on the honeycomb lattice I give the spin down just a standard Fermion and band structure, but on the squirrel lattice I give spin down a pi flux band structure. It means that I give a pi for us through every square placate on the lattice. So in both cases, the band structure of the spin down, we have a direct Fermion. And if I fix the filling of the spin down to the half field, n over 2, then the chemical potential of the spin down will be exactly less as the direct point. So we end up with this kind of field theory. And when we fix the spin down density to be n over 2, it means that on every side, the representation of the SUN magnet is like this. We have like n over 2 boxes in in one column. It's a representation of the SUM magnet. So we end up with this kind of field theory. And this is called QED3. We have a Dirac Feldman and U1 gauge field. And in total, we have like 2n component of Dirac Feldman. And it's because like the other factor of two comes from the fact that in two-dimensional lattice, we always have like an even number of Dirac Feldman if you write down a band structure without time for symmetry breaking. So like on the honeycomb lattice or on the pipe flux state on the square lattice, we both have like two Dirac valley in the Brillouin zone. So this means that so this field theory, we have an emergent SU2N symmetry instead of a SUN spin symmetry. And if you have the emergent SU2N symmetry. So in the in log n, which means when n greater than nc, nc can be calculated doing one way expansion. This theory is a conformal field theory. Means that this e squared, the coupling constant e squared, will flow to a fixed point value, and this fixed point value is the order of one of n. It's an order of one of n. Okay. So this means that this theory is not so strongly interacting because the coupling constant is the dumbbell factor of n. So when n greater than nc, and nc, I think here, nc is like 3 or 4 or something. It's not such a big value. Okay? I think it's like 3 or 4 if you do like some standard calculation. And when n is smaller than nc, then in the QED3, or 2 plus 1, I mean QED, it's believed that the system will have some chiral symmetry breaking mass generation. It means that we generate some Dirac mass gap. The Dirac frame will be gapped out. And the Dirac mass gap will break the SU2N symmetry down to SUN symmetry. So it's called the chiral symmetry breaking mass generation in the system. So which means that in this kind of honeycombized magnet or square pi flux state, when n is large enough and half filled, we should have this kind of conformal field theory in 2 plus 1 dimension. Okay.
So can you say again why you have this constraint to fix this to the stream of the
Oh yes, because basically this kind of Young Taylor means that we have like a n over 2 fermion on every side, so it means that so it's a total anti-symmetry anti-symmetry representation of the SUN. So if we fix the number, it means that I don't know how to show that without doing calculation, but actually when we fix this, actually it means that we have this kind of representation. When we define a spin model, we always fix the representation of the spin on every side, right? Either spin 1/2 or spin 1 or spin 2. That's like we fix the representation of the spin.
So for these two scenarios, n greater or less than nc, what are the two phases in terms of the original spin language?
This is a spin liquid phase.
Gapless.
It's a conformal field, the gapless spin liquid phase. And this one, you break SU2N to SUN. I think it's, let's see what kind of phase. It could be some valence bound solid pattern, actually. So you generate some Dirac mass gap, which break SU2N to SUN. And this Dirac mass gap, since I said the factor of two here coming from two Dirac valley, it means we break this symmetry. It means we generate some valence bound solid pattern. So this is this two.
What is NC?
NC is a critical n, and in this QED3 problem, NC is likely to be 3 or 4. It's not such a big number. Yeah.
So how do we know that number?
Is
it a dictionary function, or is it?
Sorry. That's an old paper in high-end community doing what kind of one-way expansion. One-way expansion, you can show that. The first order one-way calculation will give you 3.24. Yeah. So, but the higher order higher order, there are many papers I haven't really checked out carefully yet. Yeah, but it's not going to be such a big number for the QED3 case. Yeah, okay, so as I said, this formally seems all crazy because I did a lot of uncontrolled techniques. But turns out in 1 plus 1, this formalism gives us the precisely correct result. In 1 plus 1, I mean, suppose I do this kind of SUN magnet, and I do the slave particle formalism. Turns out I end up with this kind of two-dimensional, 1 plus 1 dimensional QED type of Lagrangian. Okay. Then this kind of Lagrangian, I can use the Lagrangian to calculate the scaling dimension of some order parameters. For instance, I just use the Lagrangian to calculate the new order or SUN version of the new order type of scaling dimension. then I obtain this kind of answer. Okay, the new order or the spinning slave order parameter we have screen dimension 1 minus 1 of n. So this number turns out to be exactly the same as the SUN level 1 West Domino Witten model. Okay, so this is the well understood, solvable field theory model, and give us the same numbers here. And the QED, two-dimensional QED can be solved exactly by doing the chiral rotation. So we can also calculate the number from this theory precisely. So they agree. And we know that for in one-dimensional SUN magnet, supposed to have fundamental limitation on every site, the ground state will be described by SUN level 1 with Witten model. So it means that this kind of formalism, although it seems crazy, it gives us the precisely correct result in one plus one dimension. Okay. And suppose you are not so familiar with the SUN magnet, you can make n equals to 2, and then this near order parameter have scan dimension 1/2, which actually is a number for the spin 1/2 Heisenberg chain, which I'm sure is familiar to everyone. Okay, so to myself, I never really believed the slave particle formula until I realized this. So at least it showed that in some limit, this crazy formula can give us some.
But I think in 1D there is some physical reason actually why this works.
What is the physical reason?
I think this fermion has a certain meaning of solid or something like that. It's kind of
common
defect in
1D. That is a vague argument though.
In 1D everything kind of just a free theory because all the.
This is not a free theory. I mean, for SON level 1, that's free theory. That's a free Majorana fermion. But for SUN level 1, no, I don't think. I mean, like this kind of number, when n is large, you don't expect it to come from any free theory, right? When n is 2, it can come from free theory. But for n, when n is large, you cannot expect it.
SUN level 1 can be both-sized, and for that matter, you can...
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right.
Also,
that's
SUN, you can certainly be both-sized, and also you can write it as a Western Meno. I mean, that's the Western Meno Rodan field theory. I mean, there's field theory...
Yeah, but the Western Meno Witten model, that form is not...
The Western Meno term, and it flows, and it's a fixed value.
Yeah, but you are right. It's a special point for abelian. You can do abelian boson-dation, especially for n component of U1 boson, right?
For arbitrary k, you can find
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. This is what I'm going to talk about, SUN level k. Okay, so since we know, the level 1 case is understood, so we do the level k case. For instance, I do the n orbital, actually it should be k orbital. I do k orbital SUN magnet on Heinrichs lattice again, or I do it on the square lattice, but still give like a pi flux pi flux for the band structure of the spinner. And then in this case, I want to make the limitation for the SUN spin on every side to be like this. We still have like n of two rows, but I have like a k columns in here. So now suppose I want to represent this kind of spin in terms of the spin norm, then I have to give the spin norm some extra orbital indices or extra color indices, whatever you want to call it. So this alpha, which is the extra color indices, will run from 1 to k, and a is a spin indices will run from 1 to n. And again, since I want to have a Dirac fermion, I want to make sure the spin downs will have a half field, like the fielding of spin down on every side of the kn over 2, the kind of half field. So again, and also it's one constraint. The other constraint is that I want to make sure that the alpha and the beta, this kind of indices on every side, is always SUK singlet. Okay? Because making sure the alpha is SUK singlet means that in the color space or in the orbital space, it's total anti-symmetric. It means that in the spin space, along the direction is total symmetry. This is actually why we have this kind of representation on every site. Okay, so which means at least in principle, I can represent this kind of spin model using the kind of multi-orbital or multi-color spinum. Okay, so now if I write down the field theory, then in addition to the U1 gauge field coming from this gauge constraint, I also have a SUK gauge field coming from this kind of constraint, which is the SUK singlet on every site. This is the gauge constraint. So this is like the field theory. Again, this kind of formalism actually in 1+1 dimension, actually in 2+1 dimension, when n is very large, again the theory will still be a stable conformal field theory. Okay, but now the nc is going to be much, much larger than the QED number. It's a very large number. But I'm not sure what happens when n is smaller than nc. Because the SUK gate field will confine, but I don't know what happens when confinement, when it's confined.
So the information that it's when n is bigger than EC, you get a critical theory.
Yeah.
Where does information come from?
Sorry?
Well, what is the evidence that this happens?
What evidence?
Numerical, is it?
Well, it's believed. It's believed, and we can do calculation to show it's stable. Like when n is large enough, the one
n
correction. Yeah, well, do the one n correction. We can show it's stable. Yeah, it's something we can do. Yeah. Okay. Again, in 1+1 dimension, this model is, well, I think it's equivalent to the SUN level K Westermann-Witten model, the field theory. At the conformal field level, there's a proof that a constraint fermion is equivalent to Westermann-Witten model. But here, actually, using this, just starting with this field theory to show it's equivalent to the Westermann-Witten model, the SUN level K Westermann-Witten model, the only thing I know how to do, starting with the field theory itself, is to do one way expansion again, just to assume n is much larger than k. Assume n is much larger than k, and I can do the one-way expansion to calculate the scaling dimension of all the gauging invariant order parameter. And the answer is that if I do like the, I mean, since I can only do one-way expansion, then I guess that the answer as a first order, I mean, I can only do first order. The first order is, agrees very well with the exact solution of the SUN level k with the Witten model when we use that number to do the one-way expansion. So at least this model and the SUN level K Westermann-Witten model actually has a chance to be equivalent. But I personally need to understand it better, because since I cannot solve the field theory exactly, I can only put a question mark here. I cannot prove it exactly myself.
In 1+1 dimension, it's known it can be done exactly using conformal embeddings, which is
that I know. But I want to show it's doing some other way. It kind of feels it, so I showed it myself that the one-way expansion it works at the leading order. But I want to show some other clever way whether they can do it.
So it's equivalent to what you're doing. It just gaps out the
degrees
of freedom you don't want to have.
Sorry,
say again. More obvious relations. If you look at the way Polyakov and Wigman did this a long time ago, they wrote down these models with four fermion terms. Write down fermion determinants and that whole thing, and you end up with
four fermion terms.
Yeah, that's how you get SUN level.
Oh yeah, that's right.
You can have fermion determinants involved this and that.
It's
equivalent to what Andreas said.
You can use a G coupled to a fermion bilinear and introduce
Exactly. But I mean, all that's very explicit.
Okay.
And is equivalent to what Andreas just said.
Okay. As I was saying, with alkaline earth cold atom, since n is very large, and the alkaline earth atom k equals 2, because alkaline earth atom have two orbitals, one ground state, one excited state, they both have SUN symmetry. Then k equals 2, so at least in alkaline earth atom, it might be able to realize the SUN level 2, this kind of field theory with alkaline earth atom. Okay, so that's about time, so I think I will stop here, and I will leave the burden to Leon next time.
Question? Well, two, I think a question. Actually, I want to ask a question. So, just a light question. For example, when you go from the SU2 to the SU1 model, actually, for example, you only have the U1 gauge field that you indicate by the little a mu, right? But actually, you could have a situation. I mean, for the SU2, I know that because you have a three sigma matrices, three independent. You have one constraint, right? So you have one gauge field. But if you enlarge from SU2 to higher symmetry, you can actually automatically introduce another gauge field over there. Using the orbital,
yeah,
So it's like if you really say I'm good SUN, for example, in the SU3, I can already have a line of mitigate theory.
No, in the constraint, right?
Yeah, you're constrained about the thing. I mean, you can always go back to SU2 another way, or you give. In a way, you are doing is like you only give it one gauge field, but you can just enlarge it to the SU1. But in the same time, you can, if you increase 2 to 1, in the same time, you can increase the number of people speaking. You just like given a way to do the same thing.
You can, but
For example, if you go to SU3, you can already have a bigger gauge field instead of one copy of the gauge field.
Well, depend on the rotation. The rotation will tell you what kind of constraint you want to impose on the side. And the constraint in the form of the constraint will tell you what kind of gauge field, what kind of gauge field you want to have theory. So knowing the spin symmetry is definitely not enough. You have to know the rotation of the spin.
What do you think of the 2+1D results? Which ones will be able to be either established more firmly or ruled out by numerics or computation? What are the ones that seem to have a good shot that will know the answer?
Easiest one, right? So we can check this SUM magnetic path field, which is a kind of limitation on the honeycomb lattice. Or we can just start from the Hubbard model. SUN Hubbard model with n equals to an even number on the honeycomb lattice without, at Hartfield does not have sign problem. So supposedly you are supposed to be able to do, on the Monte Carlo on it. And the philosophy is that close to the mod transition, this kind of field theory has the best chance to emerge. If it doesn't emerge there, probably doesn't emerge in anywhere else. So I'm saying for the honeycomb lattice and the SUN, Hubbard model you can do. You just check numerically and see whether it's good.
All right, so what's anything holding them back or
you were relying on the 1+1 cases, a kind of example where this dynamic technique works. Isn't it risky to talk of governments and money because they are essentially bosons? So is it a reliable check?
One dimension Fermi is not more essential than boson. I know, but in 2+1 dimension, you cannot solve anything. So forgive me for being ignorant about 2+1 dimension. It's good to have the 1+1 dimensional example, which is exactly right, than not having it. This is kind of forming. So by splitting the boson into two fermions, kind of a procedure does not depend on what kind of dimension you are in. But suppose in some case we know it's exactly right, then give us some motivation to.
This procedure is exact, right?
This procedure is right, but when you do the mean field decomposition of the fermion and you assume you have a band structure and have field theory, that's just.
In principle, you can also decompose in terms of boson, right? Yeah.
You can.
And even you can, more crazy, you can superposition of fermion and boson.
I'm not that crazy.
So actually, this is the point. Just look at this.
Actually, there's an example. In some cases, this boson representation would be much better because,
I know. And this kind of slave fermion formula is supposed to be applicable to the weak modules later. But a slave boson formula is supposed to be applicable to a system deep inside the model, when it's close to the order.
So in principle, if you consider some intermediate phases, actually you should be able to kind of superposition of these two representations.
I am indeed that crazy, actually. We have this kind of formula, actually, just treating, just to make the slave boson a slave formula in a unified formula, then. And also we can show that in some cases actually that formula works also perfectly well. It's also exact in some sense. Exact. Not exact on the level of the one dimension, but also exact in some sense. So,
Actually, I worry about this kind of a big
good, you know, since you can do the opposite way. For example, if I introduce three copies of fermions, you have a, like say, three times three, and so you have six kind of artificial local symmetry in addition to the SU2 symmetry. You can see.
Six?
Yeah, you see, those are three times three is a line. Right now, if you have two copies, you have one artificial local symmetry. You have the, so in the beginning, you have SU2 symmetry for the spin model.
Yeah.
So you have three. It's like SU2 in the same time, because if you split it into fermions, you have this emergent local.
Yeah, it's that local SU.
If you use three fermions, you know, you basically have a 9 3 times 3 9 9 3. Basically, you have a 6 artificial degree split, like a local symmetry.
Okay.
You know, if I use that, you have like this, like SU3. Basically, enlarge your symmetry from SU2 to SU3. Some of them become local because you can just local transformation. So it's like arbitrary. It's like a sense.
Yes.
So that's not arbitrary. Depending on the term, the Hamiltonian. So we're going to write a Hamiltonian and with a term which is respect to SU2 symmetry and another term for the SU3 symmetry. So depending on the ratio between the two terms, you can actually.
But for the locally, this is like artificial symmetry because you're writing S in terms of a product, the promise. Like
no, a different way of writing will give you a different orientation of the spin. It's not that arbitrary, actually. Yeah, but even, I mean, since we're talking about spin model, you already specified what kind of spin orientation you want, and that specify how you want to write down the kind of spin.
More questions? All right, thanks.